Welcome to the 26th Fireside Chat here with Tom Campbell. And we'll begin with a question from one of the MBT forum users. This question's on negative influences. Got a question about people with influence and control in PMR. You've said before that it can be a vulnerable position to be in as you attract negative energy entities. So could there be imposed a firewall on the free will awareness unit that rejects everything else than accepted input? Such a firewall should probably be controlled by trusted MPMR entities like guides and the free will awareness unit's own individuated unit of consciousness. Also, what keeps negative energies from just replicating endlessly, with energy being so abundant in non-physical matter reality? And since their existence is about degenerating, how do they not inevitably destroy themselves and each other?
Okay, that was a long series of questions. So just kind of discuss them in general and see if I hit all of them. That very last one is, how is it they don't self-destruct since they're negative? And the answer to that is they do self-destruct because they're negative. They have limits on how far they can evolve, the amount of, I'll use the word power, you know, the amount of ability they have to affect others or, other situations. So all of that is limited, and it's limited because they are negative. And yes, indeed, within societies, and there are groupings and societies and collections of such negative entities that do interact and kind of work together, but their working together is very limited because there is no trust. It's almost a tribal kind of social arrangements. Very small groups can learn to trust each other somewhat. As the group gets larger, the trust starts to fall apart and doesn't work. So you tend to have tribes, clans, that sort of thing at a very small level of social structure. You don't have much structure beyond that because they just can't get along that well to do any cooperative kind of building of any social structure. So that would be the last one first. When you say, why don't they just keep regenerating themselves? Well, it doesn't work like that. IUOCs just don't regenerate themselves and duplicate themselves as often as they wish. So that just doesn't work. As far as they're interacting with us, they can only interact with we who are here in this virtual reality by, shall we say, nudging. Another word for that would be, influencing. They're allowed to influence, but they're not allowed to directly interfere, directly, cause things to happen, do things, intrude on your mind, take over your free will. You know, all of that is prohibited. And though things like that may happen occasionally, just like occasionally people break the law here and rob banks and do other things they're not supposed to do, sometimes that happens there too. Things happen that are not supposed to happen. But in the most part, that's not the case. So when you get influenced, when you get nudged, that means you still have the free will to say no or to say yes. It's your choice at the end. So it's not that you're forced or pushed or bullied into any of these things. It's just that you have to make the final decision. So that negative being might present you with a negative alternative and encourage you to take that negative alternative. And you just have to say no and take the positive alternative. So it's tolerated here because that's part of what we are. We have evolved both positively and negatively. It's the nature of us here in this virtual reality. It's the nature of us individuated units of consciousness in the non-physical, in the larger reality. And it's part of what we have to deal with. We not only have to deal with the positive side of things, but we have to deal with the negative side too. We have to be able to say no on those instances where we're being led in the wrong direction. It's part of our learning here. So, Donna, you might look and see if I, there was like six questions in there. Are there any of them that I neglected?
I don't think so. I think one of them was about a firewall. Can we create, I know
yes,
many
that's a good
of
question.
Us, you know,
yeah,
they have the to fire, shelter, yeah.
Yeah, the firewall, basically, you can create yourself. It's not that guides or other people will create a firewall for you. We have to, you know, kind of let go of the idea that others are going to take care of us and protect us, that, you know, we are poor little individuals and we need a mommy or a daddy to take care of us when we are dealing in things that we don't understand. We have to take care of ourselves. And there is no system that protects us other than the rules that go along with this being in this physical reality, which I just mentioned. Beings, negative or positive, cannot come and directly manipulate us. We can't be moved around like little, you know, chess pieces on a board. There's only so much they can do, and they're pretty much limited to just influencing, which means giving us suggestions that we can accept or reject. It's up to us. So that's their limitation. But you can create a bit of a firewall, if you want to call it that, by doing two things. One, get rid of your fear. It's your fear is the handle by which entities can manipulate you. And that's true of any kind of entropy. If you have a fear, then you have a way to be manipulated. All one has to do is play on that fear, and you will dance and sing to their tune. So number one, get rid of the fear. That makes it very hard to be influenced, puts you in charge of all the yeses and nos without succumbing to influence of others. Without fear, you're not easily manipulated or driven or bullied or any of those things. So that's the first thing you can do. The second thing is you can use your intent to close down any communication line that you don't want to have open. Okay, now we do this automatically in a sense that we close down, you know, the communications we get from other free will awareness units. After all, there's 7.5 billion of us here, and if we were listening to the chatter of all 7.5 billion, that would be very confusing. We're all netted, that's true. And we can focus that communication link to a particular individual, and we can turn it off. Mostly, we have it turned off. It takes our intent to turn it on. Or if there's fear, then that fear can turn things on because you have expectations and beliefs, and all that can turn a communication on. So get rid of the fear and then use your intent to turn off the comm links that you don't want. So if you get some information or someone nudging you, trying to influence you, and you don't like that, just turn it off. That's done with your intent. Okay, so those are the two things that you can do. So yes, we can deal with that very successfully by getting rid of our fear and turning off the things we don't want to listen to. And they cannot force their way back in. They can only get to you if you have fear.
I think you answered that completely. He has another aspect of his question about the hellhole physical matter reality, that rough place that you've talked about in various question and answer sessions. Have the free will awareness units there gained somewhat immortality, or do negative individuated units of consciousness keep pushing free will awareness units in there to keep it as it is? Could you tell us a hint about what caused that PMR to go wrong and how the same outcome could be avoided here? And lastly, you mentioned that you tried working with that PMR. Was that from the inside or from the outside? Is it completely hopeless? And would the LCS just delete it?
No, it is not completely hopeless. The times that I were there experiencing that were from the inside. In other words, having a a body and interacting in that environment, not from the outside. I also have watched it from the outside, but being on the inside is really where you get the sense of what it's like being there. It's like the difference between watching a movie or actually being, you know, a character in the movie. It's a real big difference. It got that way just because, you know, de-evolution is a slippery slope. The more you de-evolve, the easier it is to de-evolve more. So the first few times you make bad decisions opens up a whole new set of bad decisions, you know, to make from that point. So it's easier to fall down a steep hill. You know, all you have to do is lose your balance once, right? And down you go. It's really easy to get from the top of a hill to the bottom of the hill by falling, but it's a lot harder to climb back up that steep hill from the bottom to get to the top. So you see, descent, de-evolution is an easy path. It takes effort to decrease entropy. Entropy tends to want to increase on its own, all by itself. If you do nothing at all and never put any energy into decreasing entropy, your entropy will start to increase all by itself. That's what it does. We have to put effort into climbing the hill, decreasing the entropy. And because it's so much easier to fall down a hill than to climb up it, then if you get enough people who are de-evolving, it makes it harder for those who are trying to evolve, you know, to evolve. And you see the whole thing can kind of go down on a downward spiral and end up at a very dark place. But that doesn't mean that it'll stay there. And yes, there is always hope. And no, it won't be written off or just deleted, because once you hit bottom, or once the place is a really dysfunctional place, everybody sees that it's really a dysfunctional place. That becomes a pretty easy thing to look at, that how dysfunctional it is, you see. And then you will start having, rebels groups of entities who start to go the other way. And it becomes like an underground movement, if you will, you know, to evolve rather than continue to de-evolve, and that over time has a chance to catch on and grow and become bigger, and then the whole thing turns around and heads the other way. Also, one of the things that helps that process is what we talked about just a little earlier, and that is that negative things seem to destroy each other. It's a self-destructive arrangement. So if the positive part just has to hang on a bit and grow slowly, the negative part self-destructs. So it's not a thing from which you cannot recover. It is a thing from which you can recover. And I suspect that the larger conscious system would just let that thing go and see what happens. There is a fair probability that eventually it will go so dysfunctional that the self-destruction will be so complete, and the underground that is evolving positively will reassert itself. So it will probably turn around at some point. Okay, now what do we do to prevent ourselves from going down that path? Well, every individual has to try to grow up, reduce their entropy, move toward becoming love, and that's the only medicine that works. You see, so when other people are greedy, and, you know, they lie, cheat, steal, and you're maybe on the wrong end of that lying, cheating, and stealing, you have to not join them. You have to see that as the wrong way to be, not the way to get even. And that's your choice. That's a free will choice. So the key here is not to let negativity drag you down to its level. Don't become a member of the gang that's going to grab all the marbles for themselves just because it would be convenient to have more marbles. So that's that's kind of all that in a nutshell. There's maybe a little more to it, but I think I've answered all of those.
You have
it's kind of hard when you get six questions in a row to remember all of them. As you think about one, then you think about the next, and you start to lose your grip on the first three. You know, but hopefully I got them.
You did. You did. What caused it to go wrong might be. Have you touched on that? What might have caused
it? It was just a series of bad choices. You know, as if you have a lot of entities with a lot of fear, then again, it's easier. I guess that was the idea. It's easier to fall down a hill than it is to climb up it. De-evolution is the easy path. That's kind of what causes it to get started. It's like a way to get ahead without doing the work. You know, well, you can just steal stuff from somebody else. You know, that gets you ahead without doing the work. Gets you ahead in the little picture. Gets you ahead in perhaps a material way, but it gets you behind in your evolution. You see, so now you've taken one step down that hill, and if you don't turn that around, then you'll probably take another and another until you get to a point where you've hit bottom and you realize that what you've been doing is non-productive and you need to change your life. And then hopefully you turn around and go the other way. That's what happens, is that you get to a certain point beyond which the negative becomes the dominant influence, and that dominant influence begins to drag others down. So there's just not enough individuals trying to grow up and be positive. That's kind of how you end up getting that way. So it's up to every individual to work on not doing that. And, you know, most individuals tend to be pretty good people. I mean, we look at the news and we say, oh, look at all the greed and misery in the world, and look at all the, you know, the racism and nasty things that are happening everywhere. But that's part of people. But there's another part of people that's really very nice, that's helpful, that goes out of its way, you know, to help somebody else. Not because they're going to get anything out of it other than the fact that they just feel like helping somebody else. There's a lot of that going on too. It never makes the news because good news doesn't sell. Only bad news sells. But there's a lot of that good news stuff going on all over the place all the time. We just don't hear about it. So we're not as bad off as it appears when you watch TV and look at the news. That really seems like everybody, you know, is on a fast track to destruction. And it's not like that. Most people are good people. They do care. Now, they may have faults and they may have negative aspects to themselves, but they also have positive aspects to themselves. There's something good in there as well. So we're not doing nearly as bad as it looks like, because, like I say, good news never sells. And we never see that side of our reality because it's kind of hidden. You only see those things you personally connect with. But I assure you that there's millions of people doing nice things for other people every day on this planet.
Well, Tom, in that in the case of that particular reality that this person was referring to, that you've worked with from the inside out, it may have been just a series of bad collective choices that brought it to that. Have you worked with this particular reality? You say you've worked with it from the inside out. Have you worked with it on an ongoing basis, and has there been any changes?
No, it wasn't on an ongoing basis. It was more of a... been there maybe 3, 4, 5 times, but it was just to look around and get the sense of it. It was more of an experience to have, so I could see the variation in other tight rule set reality frames and see, you know, how it can go, you know, that compared to where we are, you know, there's lots of other ways that it could go. And when you've been to one of those kinds of realities where it went very badly, it makes this reality seem very nice and very tame and very pleasant by comparison. Whereas if you've seen nothing but what you get on the news, this seems like this reality is the worst of all possible worlds. Well, it's not. It could get a whole lot worse. It's not at all the worst of all possible worlds. It's actually a pretty good place, and it's one of the best learning labs that there is. It's a very good balance here of challenge, opportunity, evolution, and de-evolution all mixed together, it's a really a pretty effective balance here. So it's good. And I was just shown a lot of the places that I've gone, I was just taken there, if you will. They were introduced to me just so I would have the experience or the knowledge of seeing how systems has evolved in other places, because it would help give me a big picture of the whole system. And that was just one of the things that the larger conscious system did with me over probably a couple of decades. It took me places, showed me things just so I would have a bigger picture of how things worked.
I think this is one of the reasons why people don't understand so well how you as a physicist have worked from the outside in and inside out to get your theory. I think if they understood this, they would pay a little more attention. The next question we have from an MBT forum user is from Turbo on misphonia causing anger. I suffer from something called misphonia. It's a condition where certain sounds really irritate you. Mine is triggered by the sound of someone eating. I consider myself not bad-tempered, but the sound of someone eating makes me very, very angry the instant I hear it. The anger I feel is real. It's so real that I actually feel like physically attacking whoever it is that is making the noise. I would never attack anyone, as I can override the urge of actually doing it, but the feeling of wanting to is still there. When the noise stops, a kind of relief washes over me, and the anger instantly goes. So he has removed himself from these situations. He knows it's an irrational fear that's just a noise, but as soon as the anger, as the noise stops, the anger stops. Could this be a consciousness-based thing, like a lesson from the larger consciousness system? Is it a more physical thing? It seems bizarre that such a thing probably, it seems bizarre to people who probably don't understand it. What's also strange is his eldest daughter has exactly the same thing. So if this is a lesson somehow from the LCS, he's unsure what he's supposed to be learning from it, as it really doesn't make any sense. He thought anger stemmed from ego. So if it is, it's for a reason he doesn't understand. Or can anger actually not be linked to ego?
Okay. That's a new one on me. I've not heard of that particular ailment, but I can assess it somewhat for him. I would like to know, it's too bad he did not include information of whether or not his daughter began showing that behavior with or without knowing about his behavior. In other words, could it have been learned, or was it just something that was in her makeup? If it turned out that he had always suppressed it to the point that nobody in his family, including his daughter, actually knew he felt that way, and then she ended up feeling that way too, then that would tend to give it a base either in biology or a connection in consciousness, one of the two. So the way he describes it, it doesn't sound like it's just a an obsession. Sometimes people get themselves into kind of wrapped around the axle, around an idea, and it just grows and grows and grows. And often, we have obsessions about very specific things, particularly things that are scary and upset us. And those are, what's the name for it? Like the fear of heights or the fear of claustrophobia. They're called phobias. Okay, phobias are kind of an obsession with a particular thing that's unsettling. And what happens is that obsession, that phobia, can reinforce itself. And it starts out not quite as extreme, but it just gets more and more extreme as the person gets wound tighter and tighter around that particular idea, that particular concept. So when you first read that, I was thinking that maybe it was something like that. And then I would approach it from the same way, from the same direction that people approach getting rid of phobias. The way that is typically they find some very mild version of what they have a phobia to and learn to accept that or adjust to that or feel comfortable with that. And then they get something that's just a little less mild. You know, like if you're afraid of spiders, the first thing you do is you look at pictures of little spiders, you know, in a book. And then you get to where you can actually hold the book and look at the picture and you don't have to turn away or throw the book down. And then you get to a point where you look at big spiders in a book. And then you get to the point where you look at little spiders 10 feet away and then closer and then closer and then big spiders and so on it goes. It takes a long time, but you work yourself up to an ability to view the spider without it creating panic in you. You see, so there's kind of proven ways that most psychologists or psychiatrists would approach a phobia, and that may be one approach for him to take. The possibility that it's physical is real because you can give people certain sorts of chemicals and it makes them angry. You can give people certain kinds of chemicals and it makes them fearful. You know, we do have an avatar body that has to function according to a rule set. And if you go in and change things in the body that has different reactions according to the rule set, then you can induce these kinds of feelings biochemically, which means there could be some biochemical problem going on in the central nervous system that has made that association between hearing the crunch of carrots and, getting angry, that it's somehow that crunch of carrots then starts to is connected to by a, you know, some neuron connection to that same hormone or whatever that's going to create the anger or the fear or whatever it is. So that's another possibility. And the other possibility is, the other one you mentioned, is that this is something that's given you as a challenge to overcome. That's also a possibility. And that your daughter may have the same thing, may give you a great opportunity to do that overcoming, because now you're not alone in this. It's not just you, you know, that this happens to. There's somebody that's close to you that has a similar thing, which makes it so much easier for the two of you to work it out together than it would be for you to just work it out on your own, because now you get encouragement and support from the other person. So if the conscious system gave you this and you were working on it and maybe not doing so well with it, maybe a daughter to help you would be something that would come along. And of course it would be part of her plan that this is a growing thing for her as well. So that's a possibility that it's like that. Now, if that's the case, then one of the ways that you can work on it is with your intent and in meditation. You use your intent, which you might call force of will, if you will, to change the condition that you feel. Change the, you know, transmute that anger into something else. Now, if it's physiological, you can actually change the way your biochemistry works with your intent. Your intent can modify your own biochemistry. So that intent can modify the physical problem if it's a physical problem. And if it's not a physical problem, if it's just a challenge for you, then you can use your intent to overcome that particular challenge. Now, exactly how would you go about that? That would be hard to tell. That's something that would be peculiar to you. The individual has to find their own tools, but you can make your tools up, whatever works for you. Start small and look for just a little bit of progress around the edges and then build on that. Well, that's sort of the way the phobia works, is that you start small and work around the edges and then build on it. So it could be any of the things that you've mentioned. I'd say it probably doesn't matter too much which one it is. It's an issue for you to deal with, whether it's a random chance connection between, you know, hearing that sound and some nervous, some string of neurons that connects that to the area that causes anger, Well, that's, you know, that's physiological. Whether it's that or whether it's part of consciousness really matters very little. In any case, you have to overcome it by force of will, by really starting to work with it. And not just, you know, you're going to sit down, think, and when you're done, it'll be over. It's not going to be like that. You're going to have to struggle with it little bits at a time, make small progress that leads to more progress. And it's will provide you with a lot of mental discipline. It'll provide you with a lot of lowering entropy skills. And if you succeed, you will have grown a significant amount in meeting such a challenge. It'd be a very positive thing. And now you have your daughter, and the two of you can work on it together and work on reinforcing each other's successes and comforting each other's failures. So that makes it an easier thing to do. So I don't really know what the cause is. Could be several, and it really doesn't matter. Just make your best effort to deal with it. Now, you already have dealt with it in some sense, is that you suppress it. Well, that makes you more civilized, no doubt, particularly if you're in a cafeteria with a lot of people chewing. But that's not the end solution. That's just a symptom reliever. That's working on the symptom. It's not working on the cause. So you really do want to set up a program for yourself to seriously work on this little bit at a time until you have it under control to where it doesn't affect you that way anymore, where you can hear people eating and you don't have any negative response to it. And that can be done. One of the things that makes that hard to do is if you believe that it can't be done. If you say, well, that's impossible, I've tried and it didn't work, well, then it will be impossible. So you have to start over. New plan, new strategy, plan A, I'm going to do this. A couple of years that doesn't work, try plan B and just keep at it. Meditate about it. Ask in your meditation how to best approach this problem and what this problem is all about. You may get some stuff that way that'll help you. So see, that will help encourage your meditation and your connections to the larger consciousness system and receiving data. So there's lots and lots of skills besides mental discipline that you learn in this process. So think of it as a challenge that will leave you much better off after you've beaten it and helped your daughter beat it.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Those are a lot of clear possibilities for a possible solution. The next question is from Adam, and that is on horror movies and violence. I found myself staying away from horror movies more and more. Is there evolutionary purpose for things meant to scare us?
No, it's actually a good idea to stay away from horror movies, Adam. We are a summation of all of our experiences and all of our intentions. Things affect us. And if we are in a very positive environment, a very loving and caring environment, an environment of trust and security, then we tend to feel better. We feel all those things. We feel more confident. We feel more sure. And that helps us make better decisions. If you're not terrified or frightened, then you make better decisions than if you are terrified or frightened. On the opposite side of that, if you see and hear and are part of things that are horrible, awful things, it will affect you. For instance, take a child walking in the park with his parents, and a mugger jumps out and kills both of the parents right in front of the child. Well, we know what happens. That child is affected, probably severely affected for a long time. You see, seeing, being a part of violent situations affects us, undermines our sense of security and well-being and trust and the rest of it. Those negative experiences drag us down. So if you want to do it in terms of physiology, we'd say that negative experiences cause brain damage. That means it causes your set of experiences to, to expect more negative experiences. It's frightening. And by brain damage, I mean that the things that happen in your consciousness get reflected in your avatar. So as your consciousness gets more fear, then that fear in your consciousness gets reflected in your physiology. The mind leads, the body follows. So we actually are doing damage to ourselves by watching horror movies. You watch a horror movie and that's just a scary experience. All right, it's not real. It's just a movie meant to scare you. And you may even laugh through some of it because some horror movies are pretty formulaic and you know just what's going to happen, you know, as the girl in her torn shirt opens the door and it squeaks, you know, and you know something's going to jump out and get her. And, you know, so you can almost giggle at some of it because it is so trite. But just the same, if you are emotionally connected to it, if you're following it, then it's going to be a drag on you. It's going to drag you down. You know, like I say, cause brain damage, cause consciousness damage. If you're not connected to it, if it's just a goofy thing that you're watching because your friends wanted to watch it and you're not into it at all and you're not emotionally connected to what's happening, then it's not such an influence on you. You just kind of ignore it and it goes by and, you know, it doesn't affect you any because you don't take it seriously. But most people watching movies get emotionally connected to the movie. I mean, that's one of the points of watching a movie, right? It's like you're there and you're experiencing the things that these characters are experiencing. And when you get emotionally connected, then a horror movie can do damage to you. Damage to your consciousness, which turns up then as damage to your avatar, which makes it more likely and easier for you to experience negative things. It sets up an expectation for fear, insecurity, that sort of thing, because you've witnessed something horrible. You've witnessed, you know, a whole bunch of people being slaughtered with a chainsaw or something, and it was gruesome. Well, that leaves a mark on you. Your psyche doesn't forget that. It's not quite the same as you were actually there, and that was part of your family. It's not that strong, but it's still there. It's still negative, and it still hurts you. So, no, don't go out of your way to experience negativity, nastiness, terror. Those are all negative experiences that will stick with you and undermine your sense of joy. So, Adam, it's a good idea. Stay away from horror movies. You know, they're not helpful. And if you do end up having to watch one because you're just in that social situation, don't get involved in it. Don't connect to it. Don't become emotionally attached to it. Stay detached so that it's just some silly movie that you're not paying any attention to, and that will minimize the damage. And when the scenes get gruesome, just close your eyes and don't watch. You see, that would be the best thing to do. And, you know, it's not just horror movies. You know, a lot of our movies that are just considered normal movies and aren't part of the horror genre are pretty horrible anyway. Now, I'd say that probably 50% of our just movies are really horror movies because they have a lot of horrible, unpleasant nastiness in them, and it works the same way. So it doesn't have to be a monster hiding behind a door with a chainsaw. It can just be people hurting people, people being unpleasant and nasty with each other, people doing things to abuse others. And that's probably in, like I say, 50% of our movies probably has that kind of thing in it. That's a downer. That doesn't make you walk away from the movie feeling full of joy and, uplifted. That sticks with you. Now, that's a part of your experience base. When you judge things and interpret data, that's part of your experience base for interpreting that data, you see. Now you're a person who has had thousands of terrible experiences. You know, they say like the average 12-year-old has witnessed something like 300 murders. You know, by the time he's 12 years old, he's seen like 300 murders. Well, that's not healthy. What do you expect from children who have, you know, watched that sort of thing? That does something to them. Same with violent video games. That does something to you. that will do more to you if you're emotionally connected to it. If you're not emotionally connected to it, like most kids really aren't all that emotionally connected to their video game, it's just a game and they're not really emotionally connected, then it has a very small effect. But all the things that are negative in our life, don't go out of your way to watch misery and people hurting each other. It's a downer for you, and it becomes part of your experience base that informs all the rest of your life. So don't fill yourself up with that kind of junk if you can manage not to. Which means it's probably a good idea not to watch the news, right? Because all you get there is negativity, negativity, negativity. All you get is the most horrible things that are working. And if you become a news junkie, you'll notice that your view of life starts to get darker and darker. And pretty soon you feel things are hopeless and it's a terrible place to live. And, you know, you end up being, you know, not necessarily what we'd call clinically depressed, but at least some depressed. And that's just from watching the news every day. So that's another one of those horror shows that you'd probably like to turn off. Not that you don't have to know what's going on, but you don't have to see it graphically. You don't have to watch, you know, the blood spurting. You don't have to have that kind of a graphic connection. And our movies and news these days wants to get as graphic as possible because that sells. It sells because it's emotional. And that's just the way we are. So I guess I said more about that than you really wanted. You're just talking about horror movies, but it's something that's very pertinent to everybody in our culture because there's lots of negativeness, lots of meanness. And if we focus on it, we become more a part of that sort of thing in our culture. It depresses us. It's not good. So don't focus on it. And when you do see it, and you do need to look at it because it's an important piece of news, then just realize that sometimes terrible things happen, but they don't have to always happen, and leave with a positive viewpoint about it'll get better rather than a negative viewpoint about it's hopeless.
All right, Tom, Pally has a small question he'd like to ask you.
Thank you, Donna. The question is regarding, training in our awareness the enemy image when we interact with people. I think you spoke to that in what you said, but I also noticed that when we speak about things we don't like governments and stuff like that, we usually tend to see the other side as enemies, and I think this enemy image also hurts us in the long run when we interact with other friends in other situations, because we are more trained to see people as enemies.
Yes, absolutely. It's a them and us kind of attitude. You know, there's us, the good guys, and then everybody else is the enemy. And if you get into that mindset, then it's really hard for you to reach out to people. You know, it's like you have your own clique, whether that's your own race or whether that's your own neighborhood or your own profession, whatever it is, you have your own group, and everybody else is either an enemy or a potential enemy. And now you have this mindset of, it's somebody that's constantly under siege. You've got this under siege mentality about the nature of existence. There's always them out there that will get us. And that leads to paranoia. And paranoia leads to all kinds of unpleasant, conditions. So yes, that's true. You need to not look at it that way. If you look at it from the viewpoint that everybody is doing what they can with what they've got. Some people have a lot of negativity and they have to deal with that. Some people have a lot of love, and they deal with that, and they also have to deal with that negativity too. But everybody's trying to get by, trying to learn, trying to grow, trying to deal with what they have to deal with what's inside of them. And that's just the way it is. Some people are doing well, some people aren't doing so well, but everybody's struggling. And everybody has an opportunity to turn around and grow up. You know, it's that sort of thing. So if you look at that way, then they're not the enemy. They're just people who disagree with us. You know, they're people that aren't necessarily like us. Maybe they have a different skin color than us or something else, you know, but it doesn't make them an enemy. They're just different. And if we can tolerate differences and in, you know, and we can kind of celebrate diversity, then we can live with a whole lot of things. And yes, it's a good point. This me versus them mentality is a real downer as well.
All right, Tom, the next question comes from MBT forum user Gerber on enlightenment. MBT really does explain everything, especially when it comes to integrating paranormal with normal. However, there's one thing that is completely absent, the phenomenon of enlightenment. According to many people from different traditions, cultures, belief systems, there is this experience of spiritual enlightenment that is supposed to have tremendous impact and be a permanent change in one's existence. Enlightenment is supposed to come with a clear, very powerful experience. It's not addressed in MBT, and I think it's unfair to ignore it considering how many religions and individuals, both from thousands of years ago and alive today, experience and describe this and stress the importance of such realization. MBT is all about slowly and steadily growing into wisdom and understanding by our effort to increase our quality of consciousness. Enlightenment is supposedly a sudden and powerful realization, often described as a sort of inner explosion. What's your view on enlightenment? What do you think it is? And also, how does it fit into MBT?
Okay. Enlightenment is a... If you keep enlightenment as a, let's say, an unattainable goal, if you keep enlightenment as a direction to move in, then I see that it's probably a positive thing. We're going to move toward being more enlightened than we are. If you see enlightenment as a destination, I'm going to work on this and then I'm going to become enlightened. It's a destination, not a journey. I guess that's the better way of saying it. You see it as a journey, I think it's probably a good thing. You see it as a destination, I think it's probably mostly your ego. Growing up becoming love does not have to happen suddenly. It doesn't have to happen all at once in a big explosion. It can happen that way, and oftentimes it's a series of smaller explosions, you know, aha moments where suddenly things become clear that weren't clear before. It's definitely that sort of thing. In general, my own viewpoint, and you've probably heard me say this before, that if somebody describes themselves as enlightened, I tend to take that as a fair sign, as a good possibility that they certainly are not. In other words, the idea of I am enlightened, okay, I've had my explosion and I'm all love and peace, whatever. If that's true, then you wouldn't want to announce it. It's not helpful. It's not useful to anybody else to do that. That sounds an awful lot like ego to me, and it sounds like it's very self-referential. So enlightenment should be a journey. You're on a journey of enlightenment. You're growing toward it. You're probably never going to get there because there is this state. That doesn't mean, you know, you individually just don't have what it takes to get there. It means it's not a point you can get to. It's like getting to the zero entropy state. You don't get there. The system is not at a zero entropy state. It's still evolving. You will still be evolving. You don't get to the end where you're done. There's no point where you're going to say, there's nothing else for me to learn. I've learned everything. I'm perfect. I am love and I'm done now. You'll never get there. You should never get there. There's always something else to do. You're never done. There's people to help. There's people to encourage. You haven't experienced everything that can be experienced. Even in 100,000 lifetimes, you can't experience everything that there is to experience. You're never done. You're always growing. And the bad thing about thinking that you're done is that as soon as you quit working on becoming more enlightened, you start to become less enlightened. You see, it's not a destination. It's not like when you get to Boston, you're in Boston. And unless you leave or somebody picks you up and drags you out of the city, you're just going to stay there as long as you want. You don't have to do anything else. You've gotten there. Well, enlightenment isn't like that. It's a process of becoming, of learning, of growing. And if you think that you are done and therefore stop making an effort to continue on that journey of enlightenment, you will start to backslide. You will start to de-evolve rather than continue to evolve. Entropy just happens. And it's not something you have to make happen. It happens all by itself. You deteriorate if you don't keep working on growth. The minute you sit still and say, I'm done, is when you start to fall apart. It's when it starts to, you start to lose it. So what I think about enlightenment is that it is a great goal as far as a journey goes. It's not a good goal as far as a destination goes. Okay, not a place to go. Now, the idea that you're going to continue to grow and become more enlightened, and let's just say enlightened is more love, right? You're becoming love. And when you reduce that entropy, and your entropy is 0.00000, you know, and then some digits, it's still not zero entirely. It's still, you can't get there entirely. There's always more. There's always work to be done. So think of your evolution of consciousness, your reduction of entropy it's a way of being. It's not a destination to get to. And you will forever be working on that way of being. And yes, you will get to the points to where you're working now more in the details and less in the big stuff. You know, it's not about angry rages anymore, but it's more about how more effectively can you help? How can you help more people more effectively? What roles can you play? You see, that becomes now a little more subtle, a little more difficult, and a little more challenging still. So that's what I think about enlightenment. It's a good idea. It's a good journey. It shouldn't be your the thing that you want to become, and then you're done. Okay, so there are some Eastern traditions that have this idea of you become enlightened, and when that happens, you no longer have to come back here and incarnate anymore. That you get out of the cycle of, you know, birth and death and do something else. Well, what is that do something else? Is that when you sit on clouds and play harps? You know, and you do that then for the rest of your eternity because now you're enlightened and the only thing you can do is play a harp on a cloud? Well, of course, that's silly. You know, it's not like that. You don't get to that point where there's no job for you. There's nothing that you can contribute to the system. There's nothing for you to contribute to the system, and playing a harp on a cloud is not a meaningful contribution to the system. If you can't help the system lower entropy, then you're not pulling your own fair share of the weight. That's what you're here to do. That's the point of your existence. And that'll remain the point of your existence as long as you exist. And as far as I know, that's a very long time. You know, I hate to say forever. Forever sounds like infinity, but forever is just as long as we can imagine, I guess. So that's my thoughts on enlightenment. Everybody is in a different degree or a different phase of enlightenment. Everyone's working on enlightenment, and we're all in some part of that process, and we'll stay in some part of that process as long as we are able to help the system lower entropy. If we get to the point where we can help the system lower entropy, then we're basically useless to the system. We've become non-functional, non-operational. And what do systems do with their non-operational parts? Well, they may just keep them around in case they wake up and get going again, or they may just convert those digits, you know, those bits back into something that would be useful again. So I don't think we want to become non-functional. And lowering entropy is what we do.
Well, thank you, Tom. I think in that sense, you do have that description in your MBT theory, lowering entropy. And that's mainly what it focuses on, even though it hasn't been given the name enlightenment.
Yeah, I don't call it out as enlightenment, and I kind of stayed away from that word, which is maybe what this person found missing, because in many people's minds, it is the destination. It's the thing we're all working to become, and one day we'll become it, and then we're done. And because that is the kind of the general idea of enlightenment, that it's a thing that'll happen to you. Eventually, you know, you'll be like the Buddha. You know, you'll understand everything and everything will be clear. Well, does that mean you're enlightened? Well, if so, then, you know, that's really not such a hard place to get to. What's much harder to do is, okay, now I understand everything. How can I help? How can I be of service? What can I do to help lower the entropy of the system? That's a much more difficult thing. So I don't really use the word enlightened because it has this concept attached to it of a final thing, a target that one day you will get there and you're done with evolution. And that's not it. Now, that's an easier sell to people. This idea when you tell people, well, you'll never be done. You just keep working forever. You know, no retirement for you guys. You know, you'll keep working and working and working. And then if you get that good, well, you'll find ways to do better. And that's not an easy sell, right? People say, oh, I don't want to join this group. You know, they never rest. They never retire. You know, they don't get to sit on a cloud and play harps. I'm going to go with some group that has a nicer picture that suits my ego better. I'll get to a point where I'm the master and I'm good and I've done all that I can do and that's it. I'll get, you know, 5 gold stars, you know, and get to retire. And do what? Become useless to the consciousness system? I don't think so, you see. That's why I don't really mention the word often, because it tends to be a word that traps people. They think they're working to an endpoint, and there is no endpoint. This is evolution. Evolution doesn't have endpoints. Evolution just keeps chugging on. It's open-ended and is always in process. Consciousness evolution. Yeah. It's not like we're going to evolve until we get to a certain point, and then evolution's done. You know, there are no more possibilities. Well, that's not likely to happen in our arrangement here. There's many more possibilities than we're going to have the opportunity to experience.